It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Payments for the expanded child tax credit are scheduled to start going out today. And those receiving these payments will get more money because of the American Rescue Plan. WESA's Kate Giammarisi has been reporting on this issue and joins us now. Welcome back to the program, Kate.
Thanks, Kevin.
Before we get into efforts to make people who are eligible aware of these payments, what is the child tax credit?
Well, so the child tax credit is something that previously, you know, existed, but it has greatly expanded under one of the coronavirus recovery bills passed earlier this year by the Biden administration. And what happened was that increased the amount of the credit that parents could get. It increased the number of people who are eligible for it. It made it so that most parents will qualify for these tax credit payments. And it also made some of these payments will be monthly rather than coming all in one lump sum at tax time.
Mm-hmm. So who's eligible for this program?
Well, without getting too much into the dollars, I would say that most families, unless they have an extremely high income, most families are eligible for these tax credits.
Mm-hmm. And it's a payment for every child. It's a higher payment for children under six and slightly lower for children 6 to 17.
Correct. It's either $250 or $300 monthly per child, depending on your child's age.
All right. Now, so you mentioned that most people, most families will be eligible. So the limits on the family income are pretty high then.
Right.
Usually the tax credits come when you file your taxes. This is the first time to receive the monthly payments. What are officials hoping the changes where these monthly payments will do? Will provide more flexibility for families? What are they hoping?
Well, I think the idea here is that people have their bills and their living expenses that they pay monthly. You have to pay your rent every month, your electric bill every month. You don't pay those bills once a year at tax time when you get your tax refunds, that it's more aligned with how people live.
So the big question is, what do parents have to do to get these payments?
Well, so many people don't have to do anything. If you filed a tax return in 2019 or 2020, you don't have to do anything. You will get your money, in many cases, direct deposited from the IRS. Who needs to do something is for folks who, for whatever reason, might not have filed a tax return.
Kate, the payments start going out today, July 15th, but is there a deadline to apply for them?
My understanding is that there's not. If you don't find out about this until next month or the month after, you can still sign up.
These payments are only slated, though, for this year. Is that correct?
The expanded amount and the monthly payments, it's only temporary. It's for 1 year. If this is something that could be made permanent, it is up to Congress. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to add, you know, particularly if this does become permanent, this has the potential to just be so hugely significant. A lot of analysis says this would cut child poverty in half in this country if this payment reaches everyone who's eligible for it. And I would also argue that this is a significant shift ideologically. Again, if this is made permanent, this is very significant in how America treats families and treats low-income families in particular.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that people, if they filed a tax return in 19 or for their 20, they're automatically signed up basically for this. But are there concerns that some people in the region who have not done that won't opt in? Why would they not? Why would there be such concerns?
The people who could potentially benefit from this the most, who are individuals with extremely low incomes, might not be aware of this, or they might, again, if their income is extremely low, they might not regularly file a tax return. And those are the people who would need this the most. And there is a lot of outreach efforts underway right now by a lot of local nonprofits to make sure families know about this. You might also recall a few weeks ago when the vice president was in town, she was promoting this program. So there are a lot of outreach efforts underway.
Anybody stand out to you? What they're doing specifically, the people that you have talked to for your reporting?
The Allegheny County Department of Human Services is sending text messages to a lot of families that receive services from the department. And there's also groups like Just Harvest and like the United Way that in normal years do a lot of free tax prep that help low-income families file taxes. And they are, you know, utilizing those resources that they have.
So, Kate, filing with the IRS can be confusing for the first time for some folks. Is there anything being done to make this process easier for people?
That sort of goes hand in hand with some of the outreach I mentioned. And also, I think, you know, there is some concern in some quarters that because this benefit is coming from the IRS, as we know, is not typically an agency that delivers social services. It's the tax man. And I think there is some concern that the IRS is intimidating and it's kind of scary to people. And there is some concern. And that's why this outreach is happening, you know, to make sure that people are comfortable with this.
Mm-hmm. If people are interested to opt in, what can they do? What's the best advice?
Childtaxcredit.gov is a website that the White House has put up to kind of help explain this to people and explain who qualifies and connect people to that portal that the IRS has that is sort of for people who might not have previously filed their taxes.
WESA reporter Kate Giamarisi, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Early in the pandemic, there were concerns that stay-at-home orders would make it difficult for people experiencing domestic violence to seek help. Now that those measures have lifted, how have shelters and supportive services changed? Nicole Molinaro is the president and CEO of the Women's Center and Shelter of Greater Pittsburgh. Nicole, welcome back to the program.
Kevin, thank you so much for having me here today.
Nicole, did the center and shelter see a rise in survivors reaching out to you during the pandemic?
We absolutely did. And not only did we see an increase in those reaching out for help, we also saw an increase in needs because of the increase in the severity and the frequency of domestic violence. So specific to Women's Center and Shelter, pre-COVID, the year pre-COVID, we served a little over 8,000 adult and child survivors of intimate partner violence. But indeed, we have seen yet another increase this year, which was a full pandemic year. We've absolutely heard that every single day from our clients.
You mentioned 8,000 in the pre-pandemic year. So for 2020, how many women and children did you help?
Right. So to give a comparison, we actually go by fiscal year, and which is for us a July to June.
Okay.
So the 18-19 fiscal year, which was a whole pre-COVID, was 8,026 adult and child survivors. When you look at the next year, which was 19-20, which was pre-pandemic up until the last quarter, we were actually on pace to reach the 8,000 adult and child clients. But we ended the year with 7,288 clients, which to us really indicated that people indeed were having a really hard time reaching out for help. And of course, social systems were removed, especially at the beginning of the pandemic. So nobody was out in the neighborhood just chatting. Nobody was going to church. Nobody was going, very importantly, very few people, of course, to their workspaces. Where oftentimes survivors have an opportunity to reach out for help. And then during the full year pandemic of 2021, we've served 8,126 adult and child survivors of domestic violence. So it's an increase over our pre-COVID numbers by about 100, which for us is pretty dramatic looking at last year's numbers.
What kind of support were people seeking when they were able to and did so reach out to you?
Sure. Well, it was a wide variety. We, of course, really saw a huge need for emotional support and for safety planning, which are always two of our biggest services that we offer and our most intense services we offer, because safety planning can be absolutely critical in being able to maintain living safely in a relationship that's abusive or fleeing from a relationship that's abusive. But we also saw a huge increase in concrete needs. So, of course, people were losing their jobs. They were laid off. partners, ex-partners, you know, child support wasn't happening anymore in a lot of cases. Our Adopt-A-Family program, for instance, which is specific to the holidays, increased tremendously during this time. We saw, I believe it was over 30% more clients participate in that program than we had in years past. We also pivoted to be able to meet these needs for concrete help. So for instance, we had never, we had always, I should say, provided for needs when folks come in, you know, since our shelter, of course, was running on site, as was our children's program, but our other services all went either remote or hybrid. So folks were not coming to the building unless they were staying in our shelter. And so what we did was had an initiative where we did essential needs bags, and we put essential needs bags together for hundreds upon hundreds of our clients. That initiative is still continuing. And then we were able to either leave them for contactless delivery or contactless pickup, I should say, for our clients, or we were able to, when safe, deliver them to the doorsteps of our clients.
Families needing to escape a dangerous home situation will sometimes go to loved ones, but also they might need a shelter such as yours. In the height of the pandemic, how did your facility accommodate shelter people?
Right. So shelter, we find that about 6% of our total number of clients need shelter. Shelter is really for those who are literally fleeing for their lives. The shelter itself is a huge, very important function of Women's Center and Shelter, and also serves the smallest number of clients with the most intense services. Typically, we can house 47 to 48 women and children. You know, in a pre-COVID year, saw close to 500 individuals in our shelter. During COVID, we absolutely had to switch gears. Our shelter was fully open and operating with all of the CDC precautions in place. So we were sanitizing every 3 hours. Everybody, of course, was masking, was distancing. We had to change the way we did meals, of course, to make sure that they were CDC approved and safe. We provided many services over the phone, even if somebody was in their room. You know, we did see less women and kids in shelter, primarily less women in shelter than we had before. So if you look at a pre-COVID year, we saw 499 women and kids in shelter. It went down to 399 for the last year, which included a quarter of the pandemic, and then went down to 318 women and kids during the pandemic. But they also had longer stays, much longer stays, which definitely impacted the number of folks that we could bring in. You know, if you think back to the beginning of the pandemic, when we were in red and even when we came into yellow, there were not options to be able to safely move. You know, there were not inspections being done of apartments. The real estate market had pretty much come to a crushing halt. So there was nowhere for folks to go. The folks who were in our shelter, when the pandemic struck and came in shortly after, stayed for a long, long time. Our typical length of stay is 45 days. And we saw folks with stays of 60 days, 90 days, and actually much longer than that.
Nicole, you mentioned that experts think that the rise in domestic violence will continue to increase for a couple years, maybe. Are there any practices or services that you plan to continue to implement beyond the pandemic?
We are actually definitely continuing our virtual services for both support groups and for individual counseling. We found that for some folks, that just works better than being in person. You know, take the pandemic away, they wouldn't have been able to come in for services, can now be served because they're able to do so remotely. We've also made great strides. And when I say we, in this case, I really mean the county, in serving protection from abuse orders in a hybrid fashion. And we've been working to implement a system where we're able to do protection from abuse orders in a fully virtual fashion. protection from abuse orders would still be available, of course, in person. But we just want to have one more option for those who are survivors of intimate partner violence. And in many cases, it can be a much safer option as well.
Finally, Nicole, what are some practical measures that, if taken, could reduce the prevalence of intimate partner violence?
You know, education is power, not to be trite, but it really is. Really recognizing the red flags for an abusive relationship and being able to leave an abusive relationship before it actually becomes abusive or before the abuse escalates into violence is really some of the most practical advice that I can give. The ability for friends and families to talk to someone who's in a new relationship that they're concerned about in a way that's not judgmental and is empowering is really critical, because so oftentimes family and friends, and you know, we've all been guilty of this, you meet someone and you get a bad feeling about them, or you think that they're not treating your family or friend the way you feel they should be treated. A lot of times, unfortunately, what happens is you tell the person how you feel about it. They disagree, and then the person just either cuts you off or fights about it or says, I told you so, or whatever the case is, right? So switching that sort of mindset with the recognition that we as adults are going to make our own decisions. So our work at Women's Center is really about empowerment. And this is how, you know, all domestic violence programs are going about their work, is that empowering. So we don't tell anybody what to do. There are so many survivors of intimate partner violence who don't have family or friends to support them, because isolation is an actual tactic that those who batter use. Hotlines are available for family and friends as well. We are not just there for the survivor or the victim in the relationship. We are absolutely more than happy, and often do, talk to family and friends and loved ones.
Nicole Molinaro is president and CEO of the Women's Center and Shelter of Greater Pittsburgh. Nicole, thanks for your time.
Kevin, thank you so much.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh-based photographer Mikel Owuna is earning international acclaim for his fantastical portraits of Black people. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll recently accompanied Owuna to see digital billboards here featuring his images.
Yeah, so we saw it from the other side, and then we did see it. Oh, there it is on that side. And that's on that side.
Mikel Owuna has parked a black SUV on the shoulder of Route 28 near Sharpsburg. The exhibit's curator and a representative from Orange Barrel Media have joined Owuna to view his first-ever public artworks as they take their turn on the digital billboards. Owuna's cousin, Isabel Analo, is here too.
There we go. That's a good one, right? That's the right one, right?
Above the roaring traffic, on a drizzly June day, the images that flash on the four billboard-sized screens are stunning. Imagine a naked human body whose skin is like a patch of night sky thick with stars, glowing purple and gold, and itself floating in darkness, as if in a womb. The series is called Infinite Essence, Celestial Liberation, and over the past few years it's been featured in museums and galleries from Kobe, Japan to Montreal, Canada. But Owuna says the showcase, on billboards and on the kiosks of multiple electric scooter stations, is his biggest in his hometown of Pittsburgh.
Seeing it here in a public-facing format on a digital screen is fantastic. I've never seen my work at such large scale, too, so I hope that it can provoke some really exciting, interesting conversations.
Owuna grew up in Highland Park. His father is Nigerian, and his mother is of Nigerian and Swedish ancestry. In college, Owuna was still coming to terms with his sexuality. His identity as a queer person upset relatives he visited in Nigeria as a freshman.
I was told that this is not of our culture to be LGBTQ, and I had a lot of really negative experiences. And so coming out of that experience, I fell into a lot of anxiety and depression, feeling like I didn't really have a right to exist.
At Duke University, Owuna studied biomedical engineering and history. But what felt most rewarding was a hobby, photography.
When I picked up the camera, I felt like I found my voice again. And it became a creative and emotional outlet for me at a moment when I felt really voiceless.
Owuna is now 30. He has been a full-time artist since 2017. The Infinite Essence series was prompted by the tragic parade of media images depicting Black people killed by police, from Michael Brown to George Floyd.
And I wanted to think about how could I, using my skills as a photographer and an engineer, how could I transfigure Black bodies from being these sites of death and state violence into these cosmic vessels?
To achieve his otherworldly effects, he paints his models with streaks of fluorescent body paint, then employs some custom technology.
So I built my own flash that only transmits ultraviolet light. And so in total darkness, I press down on the shutter, and a beam of ultraviolet light is emitted, which then illuminates the bodies for a fraction of a second. That's then captured onto the camera sensor.
His aim is both spiritual and political.
Through the medium of the ultraviolet fluorescence, we move from the visible spectrum, where we have all of these systems of oppression, white supremacy and anti-blackness, to interacting with a spectrum of light that's beyond the visible, but beyond what's visible to the human eye. We can see the essence of the black body as this cosmic vessel that connects us to the origins of the universe.
Awuna has studied traditional African creation myths, which guide his work. Marquise Redd is a scholar at the University of Pittsburgh who has written about Awuna's work.
We get a sense of a futuristic move back into the heavens, into the cosmos, understanding what human life can possibly be once we think about and elevate our understanding to a certain level.
Derek Brockington is a ballet dancer with Dance Theater of Harlem who modeled for Awuna. Brockington calls the Cosmic Portrait series transformative for people of color.
Oftentimes, the outside world can make our insides feel so small and make ourselves feel so small. And I think that with Infinite Essence, it's about bringing the beauty that's inside and the drama and the essence and the power that's inside you and showing it on the surface.
Infinite Essence continues to resonate. In September, Awuna will have his first solo exhibition in New York City at Clamp Art Gallery. He also has solo shows scheduled this year in Los Angeles and Raleigh, North Carolina. Here in Pittsburgh, Awuna's Infinite Essence images remain on display at locations including Pittsburgh Glass Center and Pittsburgh International Airport. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Rebecca Reese, Owen Trainer, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.